The World Health Organization and Wikipedia announced yesterday they're teaming up to help contain the spread of false information about the coronavirus pandemic. We are talking about the threat of misinformation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the New York Times, the first WHO items to be shared under this agreement are its Mythbusters infographics, which debunk more than two dozen false notions about COVID. So where do you turn to for sound scientific information about the coronavirus? What are you seeing out there on your social media feed about COVID? We're at 800-642-1234 with your questions and insights. Dr. Chad Temez is steering his patients toward CDC guidelines and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. He's a family physician at West Bend Medical Group in West Bend, Wisconsin. Dr. Temez, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take us to your clinic in West Bend. How is your practice affected by the coronavirus?
It's definitely become more commonplace for us to be answering daily phone calls from patients who've been affected, either directly or direct household contact, family member. So I would say that it's certainly ramped up as expected over the last several weeks and months. Our daily workflow has been affected to some degree. I mean, we took precautions early on back in March and have been able to continue with those for the most part. We're doing some screening processes to bring people into the clinic who aren't having active classic COVID symptoms. And of course, we're masking here in the office. So that has been helpful. And we've been relatively isolated as far as any shutdowns.
Are you doing more telehealth now or doing more triage via telehealth?
Yeah, so I had been doing some minimal amounts of telehealth previously just for after hours, on call, weekends, things like that. And when this happened, that had me in a pretty good position to be able to jump right in. It wasn't new for me. So, in March when things shut down, we went to exclusively telehealth just for a brief period of time so we could figure out our guidelines. And then we did mostly telehealth for a period of time. And then, there's the reality of it is patients need contact with mm-hmm. certain things. And so we just did our best to have some pretty stringent guidelines, keep our staff safe, keep other patients safe. And now we are doing probably, I would say I'm back to about 80 to 90% inpatient visits on a regular basis.
What are you hearing from patients about what they know about COVID?
It varies. So it's a wide range of things that I hear. Some are completely on board with masking, with distancing, with not gathering, and others are on the complete opposite end of that spectrum. So it's just like the state of our world right now. It's pretty divided.
Well, family medicine is also has a lot to do with education, getting patients educated about the health challenges in their life. What do you do when you encounter a patient who tells you something about COVID-19 that is completely false or something that they have gathered in a place that is just not bringing true information?
I think it depends on the context. If it's something that's directly affecting their health or a decision they're making to affect family's health, or if it's something that is potentially dangerous behavior to others, of course, I do my best to redirect and to bring the discussion back around to more science-based things that we're trying to impress on people. If it's more of a political discussion, I typically courteously dance around that topic and you just redirect the discussion back to the medicine. I've seen most of my patients for a long time, so we have a very good rapport, and it's not that hard to talk to them just like regular people. But at the same time, I have no interest in pushing an agenda onto them. And, I'm just trying to educate them as best as I can, and hopefully they'll take away with that that knowledge that I and that trust that I am trying to act in their best interest.
Oh, interesting. That relationship is there between you've laid the groundwork for that patient-physician trust, and therefore that you can be able to communicate some of the really pressing things about the coronavirus when you have that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Facebook, memes and things like that, I mean, that tends to exist pretty much in people's personal echo chambers. And so, the narrative that somebody has tends to be just echoed back to them many different times. And so oftentimes they're not necessarily getting different opinions. And the other thing is people sort of have this idea in their mind of what they think things are and what they want them to be or hope they would be. And so they tend to find stories and articles that fit that narrative and then go with those. So it's good to be able to have that chance to talk to them and just say, why is that something that you're concerned with? Or why is that something that you think we should or shouldn't be doing? And then just give them my opinion on it based on what I've read.
We're talking with family physician Chad Temez, who has a practice in West Bend. We're looking at health-related misinformation amid the pandemic, what to do about it. With your insights as well, who do you trust for scientific information about the coronavirus? How can we limit the spread of the virus? How can we be better communicate the risks to our friends and family members? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Temez, I want to ask you about science because the pace of scientific research seems to have accelerated dramatically during this time of COVID. And normally, science is self-correcting, it's slow, it's methodical, but it seems like now science is moving so fast, which may also be more difficult to adequately counter false claims. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think that, in my field, you see that science moves at that pace pretty much all the time. It's just that it's not often that the entire scientific community is focused on one topic. So I think it's a perception that things are moving incredibly fast compared to normal. But really what it is I think we just have so many more workers, scientists and researchers all working on the same topic. And because we have this shared experience with a global pandemic, you have every nation, with their top minds working on it. So there's a ton of information coming out. There's a ton of studies coming out. And so sifting through all of that is obviously, it's impossible to sift through all of it. But trying to find a cumulative set of data points and articles that are consistent with one another, I think that's the key, I think, in trying to unpack all this information is looking for consistency among the results.
Do you feel that the CDC has contributed to public confusion in the information they've put out there?
I think at times they can. It all depends on, what information they're putting out and whether or not that piece of information seems to be able to be easily politicized. It's a government organization, and a lot of people have an inherent distrust for government organizations and think the data can be easily manipulated. And so I think it's difficult because, again, people – I think have this, they just have a narrative in their head, and sometimes it doesn't matter how reliable the data is, the source is all they care about.
We're talking with family medicine physician Chad Temez about the threat of misinformation, the range of information his patients share with him about COVID. Are you worried about the infodemic, the persistent wave of misinformation? What do you say to friends and loved ones who downplay the severity of the pandemic? How do you think social media companies like Facebook and Twitter are doing to manage this deluge of misinformation flowing on their platforms? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Dr. Chad Temez here on the Ideas Network. One headline says we live in the misinformation age, and it's not a new problem. We're talking about how to combat the abundant and sometimes deadly misinformation that is spreading about COVID-19. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Early on in the pandemic, Dr. Chad Temez was hosting Facebook Live sessions to help patients understand the new deadly virus, but he stopped when he saw scientific consensus taking a backseat to politics, especially in the need for face coverings. What information do you retweet or share about COVID? What sources of scientific information do you trust? It's 800-642-1234, and family physician Chad Temez stays with us. I want to ask you about your approach to social media. Early on, you were doing these Facebook Live sessions. What compelled you to do that?
I had been following the pandemic before it got to the U.S. pretty closely on some different media sources, and I just had this strong anticipation that it was a coming wave, like many people did, at least in the medical field. And I was talking to my wife as the shutdown was approaching, and I said, you know, there's probably a lot of people who are pretty, you know, nervous or scared, not knowing what's going on. I said, maybe I can take some of this data and just unpack it for them in a way that is easier to manage, and then filter it through hopefully someone that they at least know or trust. And I just assumed it would be, you know, a couple of the people on my Facebook page. I didn't even know if people wanted to tune in and listen. Turns out a lot of people don't have plans on Friday nights, apparently, when I first did mine. So it ended up becoming pretty popular. Lots of people tuned in and were asking for more. And I tried to address as many questions as I could because I felt that was a way I could contribute and be helpful.
But you backed away from it. What was your concern there? Once you did get so many views and there was so much engagement, what caused you pause?
Well, I saw that the initial fear and just the ignorance on the topic sort of gave way to more political beliefs, and that just wasn't something I was interested in engaging in. I'm more than happy to discuss things with people face to face and let people be able to answer, ask questions and have them answered in a respectful one-on-one dialogue. But I didn't want to start engaging in political topics and having to defend basic science concepts, you know, just because they had a political, potential political slant to them. And so I just sort of backed away from it, and I continued to do my best to address questions to patients directly if they were to ask.
Let's bring in Lisa now in Madison. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead.
Hi. You kind of just touched on what I wanted to bring up is, since this began, I have seen many people as recommendations have changed. They've pointed to that as so they don't know what they're talking about and they're lying or they're wrong, versus understanding that, you know, the scientific method, when you gather more facts, when you gather more information, if that those facts and information necessitate a change in recommendations, those will be made. And that should be seen as a strength versus a weakness.
Lisa, thank you for that. Dr. Temez, you know, as we learn more, things may change. This is a fluid situation.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Lisa's spot on. I mean, the information changes as we learn more. And this was a novel virus. We didn't know how to necessarily treat it, what was best. There was a lot of conflicting data initially because it was mostly anecdotal or very small retrospective studies. And so the data and the recommendations changed, and that's normal. That is the scientific method. We will have questions. We will try to answer them. And then if that is not what we expected to happen, we'll adapt. And that ultimately should continue to happen until we fine tune the process. And it's no different than treating something else that we've been very commonly addressing over the years.
We're talking with family medicine physician Chad Temez about how misinformation has really exploded during the pandemic, how to contain the spread of bad information, and where to find trusted scientific information. Join in at 800-642-1234. I want to look where you are in Washington County, which has had more than 4,000 COVID cases, an upward trajectory. Have you seen anything like this in your medical career?
I would say it's hard to say because I don't think that I've seen anything like this because I don't know that I've been aware of many novel pandemics. But I mean, it's an interesting thing that we have, you know, this virus spreading around, and certainly it's surging right now in our county and across the state. And I've never seen so much political slants placed on something that is completely medically based. So it's been an interesting thing to navigate, having to try to balance out what the right thing to do medically is with also trying to address people's political and worldly concerns.
Down the road, when a vaccine does become widely available, what will your approach be to a vaccine as a physician?
I think it's really important to make sure that the vaccine is safe. And, you know, I think it's hard to answer that question. People say, well, will you get the vaccine when it comes out? And I would say, well, I would have to see the data on that, which is a very reasonable answer. It's not dodging the question. It's saying I need to evaluate that before I decide what I want to do. And that's just not available yet. So it's hard for me to answer that question. So mm-hmm. I think my approach would be the same with all vaccines. If it's safe and if it has a reasonable percentage of helping keep people healthier, then I would say I'm a fan of it.
Let's bring in Philip, who is joining us from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Philip.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Can you explain your situation?
Yeah, I'm going to turn 60 in 3 months, and my wife and I both just got COVID right around the 1st of October. We're fortunate that we're in fairly good physical health. You know, we exercise, run, walk, bike, and we both were pretty sick for about 3 days, then tired for 10, and have fully recovered now and are doing well. And I just wanted to hear your opinion, Dr. Temez, on the government not taking this huge opportunity to push harder on people getting in better shape, especially losing weight, and also contributes greatly to the number one or two killer in America, heart disease. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think in some sense they have addressed it in the articles and in the data. It's, you know, obesity is one of the risk factors that they mention. And so it's been addressed, I think, from a medical standpoint, but I think from a public policy standpoint, you're correct. They're talking about hand washing, masks, distancing, avoiding large gatherings. You don't really hear them saying also, you know, get out for your daily run or, you know, watch what you're eating. So you're correct. I mean, that hasn't really happened on a PR from a PR standpoint, but I think it has been addressed in the medical research.
Mm. Philip, thank you. Let's bring in Mike now in the southwest part of the state. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. I have a couple of questions. Number one, I heard different opinions. My quandary is, can you catch this out of the air? And I live in the country, but yeah, I do go to town, and I might be near in a store, or I might be even in a clinic. But I'd like to know if you can catch that just out of the air. Number two, if you buy, let's say you buy groceries, you bring them home. Okay, it came out of a store. They were on a shelf. Say for example, Walmart. A lot of people, hundreds of people come in, and whether somebody went down, they picked up a can of something to read it and see.
Yeah, you know. And because we're short on time, Mike, question number one, aerosol, and then question number two, disinfecting groceries. Dr. Temez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the data has been, I wouldn't say inconsistent, but it's been maybe inconclusive on whether or not it's aerosolized. And I think that there's the potential for it to be so. And the CDC had sent out some data that it could be, and then they retracted it, and then they reworded it. And so I think that we have seen evidence that it's probably aerosolized to some degree. Droplets are probably still the mainstay. And so I do think it's potential to catch it that way, but I think that masking reduces that. It's not because the virus can't get into a mask. It absolutely can, and it can get out of a mask, but I think the viral load that gets in and out of a mask is less. And so that may help reduce that, or at least reduce how much of it stays in the air. And then as far as the catching it from some surfaces, initially early on, that was definitely a bigger concern. I think that's much less likely. I mean, commonly touched surfaces like door handles and things like that, sure. And that's why hand washing is recommended so highly. But I think just bringing home groceries at this stage, I think that's less of a concern than it was early on.
Dr. Tamez, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Tamez is a family physician at West Bend Medical. Our colleagues at WisconText have a new article on this called Waging War on the COVID-19 Pandemic and a Parallel Infodemic of Misinformation. Find it at wisconText.org. Coming up, it's your takeaways from last night's debate as we head into the final sprint to Election Day amid COVID. We'll unpack the debate right after this news update on the Ideas Network. President Trump and Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden faced off last night in their second and final debate of the campaign. They shared the stage in Nashville with a mute button operated by the Commission on Presidential Debates. It turned off each candidate's mic for the first 2 minutes of his opponent's speaking time at the start of each topic. We have morning after analysis with room for your takeaways minus the mute here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. So COVID, race, climate change, national security, what topics and moments resonated with you? We're at 800-642-1234. Linda Green is a professor of law at UW-Madison with expertise in civil rights, constitutional law, and the confirmation of federal judges, among other areas. Linda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
So what are your top line takeaways from last night?
Well, the first debate, as you know, was a bit of a fight, a melee. The second debate...
A bit? You're so polite.
But the third debate was, a great opportunity to hear both candidates. There was no name calling. We had an opportunity for the candidates to give the 5% undecided, voters a chance to decide whom to trust for the next 4 years. So I thought it was a good opportunity to hear the candidates. What were the top topics? Of course, they ranged far and wide, but I think what I heard most was about President Trump's performance as to the pandemic and Biden's plans. Also, health care seemed to be a really important topic in the debate. The Affordable Care Act, what happens if the court strikes it down. And so I thought we had a chance to really hear the candidates. Often, President Trump talks in half sentences and just a lot of phrases. But because of the format, he actually spoke in complete sentences or relatively complete sentences. And I think people had a chance to hear his views. And at the same time, we also had a chance to hear Vice President Biden. Vice President Biden does not always speak, as one reporter said, as crisply as he might. But I thought that not only did Vice President Biden have a chance to speak in great paragraphs, he also had a chance to tell us his vision for the presidency should the people decide to elect him.
So overall, more coherent than the first debate, for sure. On the issue of COVID-19, the president says we're learning to live with coronavirus, but Vice President Biden said, quote, people are learning to die with it. President Trump said there would be a vaccine within a matter of weeks and the U.S. must be open back up soon.
99.9 of young people recover. 99% of people recover. We have to recover. We can't close up our nation. We have to open our school, and we can't close up our nation, or you're not going to have a nation.
Biden responded with the president still does not have a plan, Biden said, to stop the spread of the virus.
Fact is that when we knew it was coming, when it hit, what happened? What did the president say? He said, don't worry, it's going to go away. Be gone by Easter. Don't worry. The warm weather. Don't worry. Maybe inject bleach. He said he was kidding when he said that, but a lot of people thought it was serious.
So how did the candidate's strategies for moving forward in addressing the pandemic, how did they contrast?
Well, a great contrast. Again, President Trump said that we're rounding the corner. It's going away. We're going to learn to live with it. We're going to have a vaccine, and he did insert 2 weeks. And Biden responded, "We have today we have 223,000 deaths, and Biden said that 200,000 more people may die. I checked the facts there, and there are a number of experts who do say that we might, our pandemic death toll might be as high as 335,000 by the end of the year." And so they were totally have a completely different viewpoint. And maybe it makes sense. Maybe President Trump wants those undecided voters to be confident that this is going to go away. I think Vice President Biden wants the voters to know that the federal government must be much more aggressive if we are to survive this pandemic.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Linda Green, who is a professor of law at UW-Madison. She's providing her analysis of last night's presidential debate in Nashville and taking your insights. Did you watch the debate? Who do you think did a better job? What statements or messages from the debate stood out to you? And were there issues you wanted addressed that didn't come up? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's move on, Linda, to health care. Biden dubbed his plan for the Affordable Care Act Biden Care during last night's debate. And we saw, you know, they both clashed over health care. The president criticized the ACA and the president shared his plans for the Affordable Care Act.
What we'd like to do is terminate it. We have the individual mandate done. I don't know that it's going to work. If we don't win, we will have to run it and we'll have Obamacare, but it'll be better run. But it no longer is Obamacare because without the individual mandate, it's much different. Pre-existing conditions will always stay.
So Biden hammered him for not presenting a plan to replace the ACA. What did you hear on health care?
Well, that last passage seemed extremely incoherent. I'm not sure that I heard what would happen with pre-existing conditions. I saw the two. Health care, I thought, was one of the most important parts of this debate. The takeaways, what if the court does strike down the Affordable Care Act? The Supreme Court will hear arguments on the Affordable Care Act on November 10th. Biden was clear. He said that if the court did strike down the Affordable Care Act, he would bring back something called Biden Care. I think that was interesting that he did not call it, of course, Obamacare. And this was an opportunity for Biden to separate himself from President Obama. Essentially, he was saying, I am my own man. I thought that President Trump's attack on Biden was very interesting. President Trump called Biden a socialist. He said Biden wanted to destroy Social Security, to destroy Medicare. I thought that those were good lines, but Vice President Biden had a great comeback. He said, look, I'm not Bernie Sanders. I beat all those people. I'm Joe Biden. I thought the debate, the format of the debate gave both candidates an opportunity to be heard by the American people. And I thought that that was, I thought the format really helped us to contrast their two points of view. I thought Vice President Biden was most clear about his plan for health care. I did not take away anything coherent from President Trump's statement, but perhaps your listeners did.
I want to move on here to the Supreme Court and your insights there. The Senate Judiciary Committee, powered past Democratic boycotts yesterday to advance Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court nomination to the full Senate. And it keeps President Trump's pick on track for confirmation before Election Day. What might the future hold here for the court? And what do you see in this confirmation process?
Well, I always say that Supreme Court confirmation processes are all about politics and about power politics. President Trump has had the opportunity to put two justices on the court, and with a third to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, he solidifies the control of the court in the hands of a more conservative majority. We have to see what happens with the Affordable Care Act. It's only one of a number of issues that the court will have a chance to consider. The Affordable Care Act, there is an issue as to whether the Affordable Care Act, with the elimination of the individual mandate, whether the Affordable Care Act as a whole can stand. And you're going to hear this word severability. That simply means that if one part of a law is bad, does that mean that the court must toss the entire law? And President Trump emphasizes that it's just a small issue, but actually it could be the issue that causes a majority of the court to say that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. So that's one important issue.
So you see the ACA case as like a leading indicator, if you will, for what this court would be like?
Well, this can be viewed as a very technical issue of what we call statutory interpretation. So I don't see it as a clear bellwether for how the court will rule on future issues. But I do think that the issue, underlying issue in this case, is very important to the American people, and the consequences of the case, I think, will be great. I don't think that it itself tells us how the court will rule on future cases, but it's an interesting technical issue of such great that has great consequence in this particular Affordable Care Act context.
And on the notion of power, Senator Lindsey Graham yesterday said this is a groundbreaking, historic moment, and we did it. We're talking with UW School of Law professor Linda Green, who's with us for Morning After Analysis on the second and final debate of the presidential campaign. Did you watch last night's presidential debate? Who came out on top? What moments stood out? Were there issues you wanted addressed that the moderator, NBC's Kristen Welker, didn't bring up? And by the way, how did the moderator do? Join in with your takeaways, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute with Linda Green here on the Ideas Network. We're getting Morning After Analysis on last night's second and final presidential debate. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump and Biden were separated on stage by a plexiglass barrier. The mute button was another change by the Nonpartisan Debate Commission to help restore order following that raucous opening debate last month. What did you take away of the new mute button setup? Did you find a more traditional debate approach last night? Were you fact-checking on the fly? Where did you hear the candidates exploit the truth? Where were they right on the money? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW Law School professor Linda Green, who is our guide. Linda, let's look at their approaches to immigration with the backdrop that, you know, the parents of hundreds of children separated at the border still haven't been found. What did you hear from them in terms of substance on immigration last night?
Not a lot. I thought that the discussion of the children separated from their parents was an opportunity for President Biden to talk about a more sensitive approach to control. Vice President Biden did admit that, of course, President Obama did support detention, but they detain families with their children. And so we did have a chance to see the different policy. And I believe 545 children remain separated from their parents. And as of the latest news, the Trump administration does not know where those parents are. So I thought that was a family moment. I'm not sure that there was a clear immigration policy proposed, a new immigration policy proposed by Vice President Biden, but I thought he did say he would be sensitive to the needs of children and families. That was my takeaway.
Let's hear a moment from that point.
I'll be President of the United States, not Vice President of the United States. And the fact is, I've made it very clear. Within 100 days, I'm going to send to the United States Congress a pathway to citizenship for over 11 million undocumented people.
Okay, so it sounds like he's separating himself from Obama policy there.
I don't know if, that's difficult to say. I don't know if you can say that President Obama did not want to have a pathway to citizenship. Again, this is only going to be possible if, in fact, the Democrats are in control of the Senate. If Vice President Biden wins the presidency and the Democrats take control of the Senate, then I would expect the president, if he then is President Biden, to send a legislation. I would expect him to do that if, in fact, the Senate is Democratic. I think that would be what we would call dead on arrival if, in fact, the Senate is still controlled by Republicans.
President Trump insisted that aside from Abraham Lincoln, quote, nobody has done more for the black community. I want to talk about their approach to race relations and what you heard there. Moderator Kristen Welker asked both candidates to speak to parents who have to give their children the talk to prepare them for racist encounters. And the candidates went back and forth on what they've done and would do for communities of color. And former Vice President Biden offered his steps for working through racial inequalities.
We have to provide for economic opportunity, better education, better health care, better access to schooling, better access to opportunity to borrow money to start businesses. All the things we can do, and I've laid out a clear plan as to how to do those things, just to give people a shot. It's about accumulating the ability to have wealth as well as it is to be free from violence.
And the president spoke about criminal justice reform and job growth through the Opportunity Zone program.
Nobody has done more for the black community than Donald Trump. And if you look, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln, possible exception, but the exception of Abraham Lincoln, nobody has done what I've done. Criminal justice reform, Obama and Joe didn't do it. I don't even think they tried because they had no chance at doing it.
What did you make there of how they approached race?
Well, Vice President Biden actually outlined what we might call an approach to the elimination of structural racial injustice in the society by looking at all the sectors of activity where minorities have no opportunity. And I thought that was quite comprehensive. As to President Trump's statement that no one has done more for blacks than President Trump, apart from Abraham Lincoln, many have pointed out since he made that statement that he forgot about President Truman, who started the process of desegregating the military. He forgot about President Johnson, who was the president when the country enacted the most important civil rights legislation. Presidents we don't think of as having made contributions to racial equality, such as President Nixon. President Nixon supported increased opportunities for minority contractors. I will not say what I might say to myself. President Trump has a very complicated relationship with the truth.
We're talking with Linda Green, who is a professor of law at UW-Madison, our guide to last night's debate, and taking your insights on what you saw and heard last night at 800-642-1234. Linda, what did you make of the changes to the structure this time around and the and incorporating a mute button so the candidates could have that 2 minutes uninterrupted?
I thought that was absolutely necessary. And if we think about the purpose of these debates, the purpose of the debate is not simply to provide political entertainment. The purpose of the debate, we hope, is to allow those undecided voters an opportunity to hear the candidates, to contrast their positions on important, vital issues. And the format absolutely permitted us to listen. For the people who are undecided, they had a chance to compare the candidates on a number of issues. For those of us who have already voted or who have decided, we had a chance to confirm the choice that we've already made. I thought that it was a great format. Although we would love to have seen the kind of a spirited but respectful back and forth between the candidates that might have been perhaps even more informative, we realized that with these two candidates, that did not work. And so I'm happy that the debate commission managed to give us one last debate where we were able to hear from both candidates. I think that is really what the debate format is all about. I thought it was great, and I thought the moderator had a better chance to do her job than did Chris Wallace in that first debate.
To the point of, you know, having already voted, almost 50 million voters have already cast their ballots in this election. So is a debate like this even moving the needle at all?
Well, yes, there are a number of states. There are a number of states that are very, very close in polling, a number of states, very close polling between Vice President Biden and President Trump, what we say in politics, within the margin of error. And so some of these states, the polling shows that the voters may vote, a majority may vote for President Trump, or a majority may vote for President Biden. So even though Vice President Biden is leading in many states, other states are too close to call. So there is something of value, even though 5% are undecided, even though many, many more people than ever before have voted early, there still are states in play, to use the political term. And so I think the debate is useful. I think it's also useful in its own right as an opportunity to focus the nation on the issues we face as Americans and on the issues that we need to confront in a very proactive way if we are to continue to grow as a nation.
Linda, thank you for joining us.
Oh, so sorry. Okay, great. Thank you so much. There's so much to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda Green, professor of law at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.